Speaker Alex.
I'm Alex and Alex.
Hi, Alex.
I've been requested that I speak into the speaker by Julian. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Can you hear it? Right, good. As long as you can.
I can't speak English, but you can hear you. Just saying.
Right. I don't really want to inflict my accent on people normally, so I'm throwing myself into this. You probably won't remember this, but last time I did a show and you were chairing the meeting, the first thing we talked about between each other was how it's really boring when people start by saying they're nervous.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I'm going to be boring and say I'm nervous. That's all right. And I'm sure I'll warm up a bit. The thing about doing this chair is every people coming up to me and say, are you doing the 40-minute chair? And you go, yeah, I'm doing it. And they look at you with some sort of pity. Okay. So, yeah, I'm a bit nervous, but that's okay. The thing I get nervous about is speaking for 40 minutes, which is kind of crazy because I love speaking about myself, really. And pay someone to listen to me speak for about an hour a week at the moment. I'm going to see a therapist, which is great. And I never leave in an hour. I'm always run over. And he has to push me out the door. So I've got lots of people listening to me today. But where to begin? I came into these meetings when I was 22. I came through a rehab, and I'm sure I'll go through that story in a minute, but I was 22 years old and I'd been using drugs for 8 years, and every drug. It wasn't about any particular drug. Towards the end it was, but I walked into a rehab and I identified myself as a drug addict. And 13 years later, I'm here and I consider myself an addict, and I still identify myself as that. And I guess the difference for me between those two expressions is that when I came into recovery, it was all about the drugs. It wasn't about addiction. It was about what I was using, and I really thought that everything that was wrong with me was physical. Now I see that my addiction is very fast spreading. And even though I don't use drugs anymore, I don't smoke, I don't drink, the addiction is still there in me, and I have to deal with that on a daily basis through lots of things that I do. And by the time I sort of came into a rehab, the first thing that I learned about that I was powerless over my addiction, and that my life was unmanageable, and I was told that, and I thought, I don't know really what that means. I didn't have a clue. I've been using since I was 14, and I'm going to talk about different drugs, but it's not because I'm saying that that's the particular problem. It's just the behaviour around how every single drug I encountered gave me certain behaviours, and things happened around it that now, looking back, I can see that each one was something that was part of my addictive cycle. Even if I didn't use it every day, it was part of my addictive cycle. And I say all this stuff now. I look at it now and I can see that, but I didn't see it when it was happening. So. I came from a bit of a crazy family. I didn't think it at the time. I thought I was in quite a normal family, and I'm not sure if the things that happened around me as a kid made me an addict. Doesn't matter. Don't know if it's a family, it's passed on through the family. It also doesn't matter. Don't know if it's things that happened to me late. I just don't know, but it doesn't matter to me. I kind of just accept that I am what I am, really. My mum made some interesting decisions as I got a bit older as a teenager, and I won't go into them. And weirdly, something very significant happened in my life as a kid, and I've never talked about it in a meeting. And I was sort of considering that. I was considering that this week. And I don't talk about it because sometimes I feel like that's my bit of respect to my family, even though they never hear what I say in these meetings. Sometimes I don't need to go into the dirt, you know? So I keep that kind of stuff to myself. But she made some decisions, and I was kind of left living with my dad, and I was left living as a 13-year-old with my dad. And my dad traveled a lot for work, so I was left alone and trying to look after myself and dealing with some things that didn't feel very good. And I guess one of the first things that was a part of my addictive cycle was taking prescription drugs. And I went into the doctors as a 13-year-old, and I remember the words I said, and the words were like, just give me a break. I just need something to give me a break. I need to stop thinking like this for just 10 minutes. Just give me something to help me sleep. And I don't think that's normal for a kid. You know, I don't think that's normal. I'm pretty sure that you can't go in as a 13-year-old and get that kind of stuff now without your parents knowing. I hope that doesn't happen. But I was given antidepressants and sleeping pills, and I did not use them the way I was told to use them. I did go to counsellors, but I would lie. I wasn't really willing. And I would lie about the other drugs I was taking because I couldn't see that those things were having any other effect on me. It didn't sort of compute to me that using those was making me feel bad. And I just wanted to be different. I didn't want to be around people. I didn't want to be part. Everything about society scared me. It was kind of boring, and I didn't look at the way things were going forward. And like, I just didn't have any aspirations. So I used to like go and hang around with all the homeless people, and that was like my evenings, is going hanging around with people who would sleep on the streets. And like, you know, and one day someone walked up to me in the street that I knew, and he went, "Here you go," and he passed me the end of a joint. That was not the first time I tried to smoke pot, though. It was I was walking around one day and I thought, I'm going to do it. So it wasn't like peer group pressure gave me that first drug. I decided I was going to go out and smoke it. And I went out and I looked around the streets and tried to find someone who would sell me it. And I bought it. No fucking idea how to roll a joint. Shoving it into an old cigarette and trying to smoke it. Obviously didn't get high at all. My dad came home. It's a weird smell in the house. I was just like, oh, it's my hairspray. But not that much longer after that, someone passed me this in the street, and I remember that clear as day. He gave me it, and I took it off him, and at this I just thought, you're giving me a cigarette. But as soon as I had that first bit of it, wow, what a feeling. And I walked off down an alley, and I bounced down there, and I felt like I was walking on air. And it was like, and it wasn't just like, this is fun. It was like, I want to feel like this every single day. I want this all the time. And I didn't start to do it every single day, but it didn't take long. My sister used to live in a house that was there was three stories, three flats. Everything was painted black. There was far too many people with ginger dreadlocks, and it was all a bit crusty. And one day they had a party in this house, and I went round to the house. Everyone was taking drugs, and I picked myself up a boyfriend pretty quickly. And he introduced me to every drug really quick, you know. And I jumped on that. And where I'm from is like, I'm from a small town, and there wasn't really a nightlife there, but there was a lot of outdoor parties, and that was the way people lived. And I shaved all my hair off and pierced all my face up and looked pretty terrible. And but I'd go to all these parties, and I'd just like, we'd sat on the beach, or we'd be sat in a quarry, and it was just, everyone was getting high. And I remember the first time someone gave me ecstasy, and I took that pill. And I sat on a rock, and I didn't move for about 8 hours, and I had the best night of my life. And at some point, someone dragged me home. And again, it was like, I need to feel like this all the time. I just got into that scene, and it was great. I felt alive. I felt like I was different to all the kids I was at school with. I went to an all-girls school, and like, I would walk down the street, go down an alley, smoke a joint on my own, go into my classroom. There was no one else like that. You know, I wasn't being pressured into this stuff. I was chasing it. And I used to see it on TV before I ever picked up a single drug and think, I want to do that. Like, it was in me. It was raging. And I really stuck around that stuff. I stuck around it for 8 years. But ecstasy and pills and the speed and all that stuff was fun for a while. And cocaine was fun for a while. And I used that a lot. You know, I had a boyfriend who dealt, and we used it together all the time. And you know, it's like, this isn't one of the horror stories, but this is the time I remember, is being in my house. For some reason, I was like ironing my bed sheets. It was just like this kind of crazy mania. I always had to be doing something. I'm just ironing and moving around because I couldn't sit and still and be restful. And my friend came around, and we had a few lines, and I remember my nose bleeding and my skin's crawling. I'm pulling like imaginary bugs off myself, and I felt fucking horrible. And I thought, I'm never doing that again. It wasn't like I'm not having another line right now, but I'm never doing that again. And within 10 minutes, I was doing it again. And I remember that at 16 and thinking, why did I just do that? Like, that's part of my addictive cycle. That's part of me and the way I behave around drugs. And I continued with that, and soon that got boring, and then heroin came on the scene, you know. And I was with a guy for most of the last part of my using, about 5 years, and it was, we used together all the time. And I remember it starting with, here's just the thing to come down off the end of a party night. Then we didn't really go out and take anything to party with. We take our room right from the beginning. Then we take it on Sunday. Then we take it on Friday. And then it's Monday. And then I was addicted. It took me 2 months. It didn't take me long. And that was kind of stupid. I was young. I was dumb. I didn't really know what I was doing. I remember the first time I realised it was a real issue is because I was thinking, oh God, I've really got a bad stomach ache. I don't really feel good. And we were on the phone. And I'm on the phone to this guy. And I'm just like, God, I just don't really feel. And then he's like, do you think it's because we've had too much? And I was like, maybe it is. And I said, you know, if I didn't have this stomach ache, I could probably handle this. Let's just get some methadone and take that for the week. And then we'll get off it at the weekend when we're not busy and everything will be fine. Obviously, that's complete nonsense. But then he calls and he says, I can't get that, but I got you some more gear, so just have that every day. And then I was hooked. Then I was using it every day. And for the years that I used it, I was always trying to stop. It wasn't like I was in it thinking this is great. I just wanted to stop. And I tried everything. One of our things was to, like, my dad has a house in Poland. It's like there's 12 houses in this village. It's in the middle of fucking nowhere. And we go over there and we're like, well, we're just going to sit here for a week and we'll be fine. But we take it with us. You know, it's like, we go on these trips and try and stop. We tell each other we were going to stop. He'd be downstairs using it. I'd be upstairs using it. I could hear like a plastic bag rustle from a mile away. Ears prick up like a bat and I'm running upstairs. And we'd lie and cheat around each other. But we did want to stop. And I had a job for a couple of days a week at one point. Like, I studied all the way through the start of my using. And then I kind of came back to where I lived and I worked in an old ladies' clothes shop, and I was like kind of dressing like 80-year-old women and stuff, and like just sleeping on the floor behind the counter. It was absolutely horrendous. And I had to get trained for this job. It wasn't that far, but what one of those things that reminds me of how fast I had to use, how incessant my using, how compulsive my using was. I used to wake up, I'd leave it as long as possible, reach under the bed, I'd dig around for what I'd left under the bed. Usually I'd used it in the night, sweeping off cigarette butts that I've smoked in the night, or I'd burnt my t-shirt, or burnt through the bed covers, and whatever was left over, I'd use a bunch of it. And it was 4 minutes walk to the train station, and I timed that because I wasn't hanging around for too long. 4 minutes walk to the train station, and I'd use in the toilet when I got there. And I'd go in the toilet before the train came, so that's 4 minutes. I couldn't wait any longer. I'd go out and score, and by the time I'd get back to my house, I'd crawl up the stairs. I couldn't get up the second flight of stairs. I'd crawl up the stairs, and if I'd been out for ages and I needed the toilet, I would go and just sit in the bathroom. There's no point going downstairs. It was like that human need and my need to use was that, like, they were both comparable. I mean, I just couldn't wait for it. And that kind of desire and frustration that I have in me to meet my needs all the time is quite strong in me, and it's still there in me in lots of different ways. And it's that, what's the expression? I don't know if anyone's ever heard that marshmallow test. I read about this thing called the Harvard University do this thing called the marshmallow test. And it sounds a bit cruel, actually. They take those like three to five-year-old kids and they put them in a room, and they put them in a room with a plate and a marshmallow, and then they cover it up. And they say, you can have this marshmallow if you want it in 10 minutes. And then you'll get a second one. Well, they say, if you take it now, you can have it, and that's it, you're done. Or you can have it in 10 minutes, and then you'll get two marshmallows. And I read about this, and I was like, I last 2 seconds. You know, that it's that instant gratification. I need stuff now, sugar, anything I want to buy, relationship with someone, sex. I'm after everything immediately. I've got no... There's no way for me to stop myself and wait for things. And I identified with that because it was like something I was like when I was a kid with sweets and stuff. And apparently they looked at these tests, and 20 years later they looked at all the kids to see where they were in their life. And most of the kids who couldn't wait had problems around addiction, depression, chaotic lifestyles. You know, and I saw that, and that's what using for me is about. It's instant gratification. It's obsession and compulsion. And when I was taught about obsession and compulsion and I was in the rehab, it was like that really made a lot of sense, because I would constantly tell myself I was going to stop, And I'd be walking down the street thinking, well, what are you doing? You said you weren't going to do this. Like, how are you doing this? Completely lost about, like, how I had no willpower. How could I not stop myself? Like, how could I not know better than this? Because I thought I was smarter than that. So, 8 years of using, 8 years of fucking around, getting myself in problems, debt, not getting anywhere in my life, feeling bleak and black and in a very dark place all the time. And I finally ended up in a rehab, and I know a lot of people's experiences, they don't go for a rehab, they come into these meetings and this is where they get it, and I think you can do both. I feel very lucky that I got that. It was a 12-step rehab, and I was immediately taught about the 12 steps. And I said to you before, the first thing they said to me was like this, powerless and unmanageable. I didn't get that. I didn't understand what that meant. I didn't understand the language of the steps. It was just, and I didn't really care. I didn't come for some sort of mental therapy. I went because I wanted someone to detox me, and I wanted to get detoxed so I could get back to having a little bit of a use at the weekend. And that's why I had my decision. That's what I wanted. But by the time I got into this rehab, what I remember is them going, let's show you around. Like, I'm going to show you around this rehab, and we can come see the rooms, and we'll tell you about what's going to happen, and we'll tell you what drugs we're going to give you. And I just remember sitting just going, I don't want to. I don't care. Like, I'm not bothered. Do what the fuck you want. Like, at this stage, just do whatever you want, because I'm done. And years later, I understood that that was me admitting that I was powerless, and that I couldn't do this my way. I couldn't stop using my way. I couldn't do it on my terms. I had to do what other people were telling me, because my ways, all those kind of like trips away and things like that, all those excuses, even one of my drug dealers, the first guy who ever sold me drugs, and a guy who I still see using right now and dying in front of my eyes, he sat and listened to me and my boyfriend talking about these reasons of why we couldn't stop. And, oh, if we could just get to the weekend and we haven't got work and all this. And he just went, listen, shut up. What is this bullshit? You're not stopping because you don't want to. And I remember us being like, whoa, who are you talking to? You've been using it for 20 years. Fuck off. But he was right. He was right. There was always those excuses, and it was always going to be our little dance around the way we were going to do it. And when I went into the rehab, it was the first time I was like willing to do whatever. I wasn't willing to do whatever every single day, that's for sure. The first few nights of being in there were horrendous. The first night I went in, they took me and gave me a bag search, and there was a power cut, and I lay in the dark in the pitch black room thinking the world was about to end, and it was the most horrendous start. And I remember thinking that they were going to come in like, I don't know, give me something, give me a pep talk. And after about an hour and a half, I thought, they're not coming back. This is me in here, done. You know, this is the end of it. And I'd gone in there with my mum, and my sister had driven me. And even that day, it was just like so pathetic. I kind of got up, and I remember like kind of throwing myself onto the floor in the drama and digging through this pile of shit, trying to find some underwear to take and pack into the rehab, and just calling my mum, just going, I can't do this. You have to come and pack for me. I don't have any clothes that are clean. I don't have anything anymore. And her coming and me just saying, give me whatever money's in your bag, and her emptying my her handbag, and me scratching all the pounds together and then going off to get my last bag and thinking, well, I had enough energy to do that. I had enough energy to go and walk across town and get that. I didn't have enough energy to put some like socks in a bag, but and I used in the back of the car, and I just remember my mum and my sister being like really disgusted, you know, really just like they'd never seen me do it in front of them. The days before I went into the rehab, my dad went, okay, so we're going to put you in here, and this is what we're going to do, and so just don't use for the next few days until you go in. I was like, well, why do I need to go in a rehab if I can stop for the next 5 days? He didn't understand it. He didn't understand it, and my family didn't understand it, and people who didn't use didn't understand it, but the people who did understand it were the people in the rehab and the people I met through these meetings. And actually, when I went in, there was a few days, and then they sort of took me into this group therapy session, and there was a lot of people who weren't addicts in there, and it was kind of a lot of a mix of different people, and I really didn't identify with it very much, and I was kicking off, really. I was making a bit of a fuss. But about 5-6 days later, another guy came in who had the same addiction as me. And again, it's not about us using the same drug, but for me it helped at that stage. And suddenly there was someone else going through the same thing, and it was the first time in my life that I was looking at someone else who was trying to stop using, who felt the same as me, because I felt like I was just, I just felt like I was completely useless. What's wrong with me? Why can't I stop this? Like, surely I'm better than this. And I went through the 12 steps in there, and they taught me a lot. But the thing where it really started to change is where they started taking me to meetings. There was only AA meetings in that, and they would have them on a Saturday, and they took me down, but they didn't explain what they were doing. They were just like, there's a thing on Saturday you can do, go downstairs. So I went downstairs, and I was just like, what the fuck is this? And I remember coming out thinking, that's cute. It's so nice that these alcoholics have got someone to talk to. Super patronizing. I didn't drink a lot when I used. Like, I didn't drink a lot, but now, like, I identify as an alcoholic if I go to an AA meeting. You know, I didn't drink a lot, but the times I did, if I think about it, it was like, I would drink the full bottle of whatever it was, and like wake up passed out in the bed with my boyfriend shouting at me, or throw myself into his bath, or like puking in the street. It was blackout drinking the very few times I drunk, so I have that. That is my issue too. But I didn't get that when I went in there. And I went back the next week because there was a really cute guy in there, and he had really nice and he had great trainers on, and he turned out to be really boring, but off in the way, but he got me back. You know, and sometimes it's just whatever it takes. I don't know, that wasn't the right reason. You know, and he got me, made me have a shower the next week. So there I was. And I started going back into these meetings, and I started to kind of get it. I started to understand it a little bit more. But we used to sit and do like these, go through all these different steps, and they were kind of like teaching you about all the steps, and that's what I was learning in that rehab. And what I remember them doing one day is saying, only, I don't know where this statistic comes from, because I think it's shit, but only 3% of you are going to get this. Only 3% of you, and it seems to be a different statistic wherever you go, but only 3% of you are going to get clean and stay clean. And for some reason, in that very moment, I went internally, thought, I'm going to be that 3%. That's going to be me. I'm having this. I don't care about anyone else in this room. It's going to be me, because I don't want to live this life anymore. And I'm starting to see that it can be better. And after that, I was just so committed. It was just like, and again, I was in that place of, I'll do anything. And I'm not doing it on my terms. I'm doing it on the terms that people suggest to me, really. And I went on to another rehab anyway. I mean, that was part of my journey, but I came out. I came back from where I was, and I went to my sleepy little town in Lancaster, and expecting to walk into this meeting buzzing full of people, this vibe, it's going to be great. People will be like really happy that someone from Lancaster was clean. Like, I really thought that. And I walked in, and there was like four people sat around, and they kind of looked at me like, I mean, literally, I got attitude. And I was, okay. And I sat down in this meeting, and honestly, I walked out on a Saturday night after the meeting, and I cried my eyes out on this bench and watched everyone out having fun. And I was like, this isn't for me. Like, what is this? And I always remember that and think, make sure you're welcoming when you're at a meeting. Like, it's very easy for a newcomer to walk in and just look like they're a part of the crowd. And I'm guilty of forgetting that sometimes, but make sure that you say hello to people when they come in and make them feel welcome, and make it look like a fun place to be or a positive place to be. And I try and remember that as much as I can. And you know what? All those people who were sat around that table are still in meetings today, actually, in my town. And now I go to the meetings and there's 30-odd people or more. But at that time, there was one meeting a week in that town, and I had to go and get on the trains and buses and schlep all over the county, and I made myself go to meetings every night, and I was just completely willing to do it. I went as far as I possibly could, and I threw myself into it. I got a sponsor, I started working the steps, and I was just in. And for the first 5 years, it was really hard. Last time I did a chair here was I was 5 years clean. I just moved to London. It was a new phase of my life, and I was kind of talking about this with my friend this week, and it was it was nice being invited to come and do this. It made me think about what's happened in the last kind of 7 years and these different phases in my recovery. And the first 5 years, it wasn't like I got a job and I got things in my life, and it wasn't I didn't have a career. And I couldn't get in a relationship. I got in a lot of very short relationships, like a week or a night, but that was my thing for a while. Learned my lesson around that. But it took me a long time to find my feet. And I was quite young. Obviously, things were like, I was growing up as well, but I don't know if anyone's early around and just feels like there's a lot to deal with and things aren't falling into place yet, but it took me a while, and that might sound disheartening. 5 years might sound like a long time, but it took me a while. And I just kept pushing forward and I kept doing things. And when I lived here, so I did a share here just before I moved to go and live in Borneo, and that was another stage of my life. And it's kind of a long story, but after living here, like my life started to really take off. I went into a career and started to build a life for myself, doing all the things that I really wanted. I lived in Borneo. I got into a relationship that was the best relationship of my life. You know, I'm not in it now, but that's okay. And I lived in my dream house. I traveled everywhere. I had all these incredible things, and I was living in a country, or part of the country, where there was no meetings, and which is not something I recommend, by the way. I'm not sharing that as something I'm recommending. A lot of things happened that took me over there, and it was the right thing for me to do. But I realised what it's like when you don't have this in front of you, when you don't have meetings to get to, and you can take this stuff for granted really easily. That identification, being around people who are like you, being able to pick up the phone to someone at any time of the day or night, just stuff around it, just having meetings. It's a big change when you don't have it. But I stayed clean. It was a really amazing part of my life. But a lot of the time, I had to get on planes to go to meetings sometimes, and I would push myself, I'm going to go and take a trip and go to some meetings for a couple of days. And I'll tell you about that. So when I moved over there, the first time I went over to work, there was no meetings. The second time I went to work, there was no meetings. The third time, after about 6 months, I'd look on the websites all the time to see if there was any meetings around that area, and it never showed up. But one day I opened like a local paper and there was an AA meeting advertised in there, and for some reason it wasn't on the website. And I called the number and this guy answered, and I was like, oh, can I come? And he's like, yeah, it's at my house. And I was like, okay. And he's like, just ask for Dr. Jaswant. And I was like, oh. Doctor, okay. I'm gonna say that's not his real name, but it is. Whoops. he's 8,000 miles away. You'll never meet him. And I turned up at this guy's house, and again, I was in a meeting with four people, and he was a doctor, and it was in his house, and he had a doctor's surgery, and we went in there, and we had this meeting, and it was 2 hours long, and there was four of us, and there was no. There was no structure to this meeting. There was no cards. Nobody announced themselves when they spoke. There was no literature. There was nothing. And I have to say, like, kudos to these guys. Like, he got clean and sober over here and learnt about it and gone back, and he kind of found another guy who was very religious but an alcoholic, and they'd formed together and they started a meeting. And I just think big respect to them for doing that. And I was sitting in these meetings and think, this is like the old days, Dr. Bob and Bill, this is what it is. And they were, there was a doctor, and one of them was really religious. It's the same thing. And it was, but like Malaysian style, you know? And it was me. I don't know which part of the dynamic I was. And there was another lady there who never really said very much. And I was suspicious at first, and I was right to be. And, you know, at first I just sat there and just thought, don't plow in and say your bit. Just be part of it. And I was for quite a while. But one day it's like, do you know what? When we're in England, we kind of have these cards and we read them out. Would you mind if I brought them along? And they were cool. And I sort of introduced little bits here and there. And I'm sharing about this because it was my first experience of really understanding the traditions and how they work in your life. So they were breaking quite a few of the traditions. And I found out that this lady, after a while, so wasn't an alcoholic, but she was very interested in alcoholism. And I just thought, well, everyone else is okay with it, so I'm okay with it. But I'll tell you, there was one time I was sharing in this meeting, and I was just talking about how I'd done it. And she just turned around and went, so how did you do it then? I know it sounds stupid, but in that moment, someone turning around and asking you specifically, directly in a meeting, felt so invasive to me. And I had a feeling that she wasn't a part, she didn't identify as an addict or an alcoholic. And it felt really invasive. And it felt like, it reminded me of why it's so important that just us guys, us lot, we come here, you know? I know we have an open meeting once in a while in this occasion as well, but I just, I want to be around addicts when I talk about my addiction. I want to feel like I'm in a safe place. I don't want people to ask me questions. And I want to be in a meeting where I get to share and people listen. And that's a really important part of this. And they also had some great ideas about trying to spread the message of this program and printing out leaflets and going and sending it around. And the doctor wanted to get the hospital to fund them. And I said, you can't do that, you know, because now you're linking it to the hospital and what happens in there, and if they do have a different opinion, it doesn't work. So we paid for it ourselves, and we put those questionnaires out and we put them around town, and a few weeks later we went to go and check on them. People had filled them in and popped them back with the answers, so we could go and do a survey and see how much people were drinking in the area. I don't think they really got it, but and then some weeks later, a year later, other people joined our meeting and it got bigger. And then one day someone came to me and said, you know, I have a feeling that this lady, nameless, isn't an alcoholic or an addict. And I went, oh yeah, I know. And they said, well, I don't want to hear. And I was like, all right, okay, I'm really sorry, I should have said something. But I realised that it's damaging. It is damaging, you know, and those traditions are there in place for a reason. When someone wouldn't show up at the meeting, people were concerned, but they would share about it at the table. And I said, no, you can't do that. And it was so hard, honestly, it was so hard to be, you know, that teacher's pet going, I'm sorry, you can't say that. And the meeting, it was not, yeah, I didn't like it, but I did it. And I think in the end it paid off. Like, it became a formed meeting, and it became a place where people felt trusting in the process. And when I was there, I spent quite a lot of time in that meeting, and then other people arrived in that town, and we set up a meeting, and now there's an NA meeting over there. And again, that started with four of us, and I went back last year, and now there's 30 people at that meeting on a regular basis, which is cool. It's super cool, in the middle of Borneo. You know, and a place with lots of, you know, lots of religions and different cultures and ideas around drinking. The rice wine over there, my God, it's crazy. You know, there is a definite culture of drugs and drinking, but it's not heard about. It's not culturally appropriate. It's hidden. It's really hidden. So I feel really glad that that's going to happen over there, and things are going to change. And now I'm back here, and that was a bit of an accident. I said that to someone before. It was a complete accident. I ended up living back here. And it's interesting. I've been back here for a bit, and now I feel like I'm around meetings, and I'm kind of plugging in more than I have done in years. You know, I really push myself. I came back and I was like, I'm too busy for service, for a really busy job. I do have a really busy job. I do two jobs. I do a lot of stuff. But then I took on some service and I realised, actually, it's not that hard. I'm there every week. If I can't go, someone else does it for me that week. I put so many things on myself where I can stop myself being involved and like putting these, you know, I can be really lazy about it. I have a really nice process at the moment with my friend, and we text each other an inventory every night and a gratitude list every night, and just that little contact every single day just keeps me safe, keeps me rooted in this, it keeps me a part of. And I'm working through the steps with a sponsor at the moment who is taking me through the long way again, which is good. I'm all right with that. I'm okay with it. And it's interesting for me that I did the step two with her. And she asked me to start praying on my knees, and I didn't want to do it. And I haven't really talked much about my sense of higher power, but part for me, I struggle with it. A lot of people struggle with it. I remember going to a convention really early on, and I got to the point where everyone stood up and held hands, and there was like 400 people in this room holding hands, and I felt that power. I felt something. I felt heat in that room. Whatever it is, there was a lot of people in the room. It's going to get hot. I mean, that's power though, isn't it? It's something. But I felt that, and I felt a little bit more connected, and I feel the power of being in these meetings. I feel the fact that somebody can support me at any time. And You're giving me a nudge then, but it was an accident, wasn't it?
No, I'm actually, there was just a little fidget to tell you 2 minutes.
Is it 2 minutes? Oh, yeah, I don't get to the right half past. God, I haven't finished yet.
You can't go to half past.
So much to say. You sure?
Yeah.
I thought I'd be drying up about 20 minutes ago, you know. It's not as bad as I thought this, once you get going. Yeah, so my sponsor asked me to do that. And 12 years into my recovery, I had to reevaluate my higher power, and that's okay as well. I remember being in Bali at one point, and if anyone mentions Eat, Pray, Love at this point, I'd split up with my boyfriend, and people always like, Eat, Pray, Love, and I'm just like, fuck off, if you've read that book. And I was having a bit of a moment where everyone there's very spiritual, and everyone's like, I'm going to be a Hindu, I'm going to be a Buddhist, I'm going to do it. And I was around all this stuff, and I was in these meetings and thinking, God, mine's not good enough, my higher power's not good enough. Because I believe that my conscience tells me what's what. I believe that when I was using, there was a bit of me always saying, don't do this, don't do this. But it wasn't big enough. The voice wasn't big enough. And when I got into recovery and started to connect with the steps and the program, that voice got bigger and told me to look after myself. And that's all. And that's my conscience. And I don't know where that comes from. I don't really believe in a God, but I've prayed on my knees before because I felt like that's just something you do. But as soon as someone told me to do it, I thought, no, this is not for me. This is not part of my process, and nobody needs to tell me how to do that. And that's all right with me. My concept of a higher power is mine, and it works. And that's been really important to me in this year that I've learned around that stuff. But I feel at this moment in my life, I feel really kind of safe. I feel like if something goes wrong in my life, people will pick me up and look after me. And I feel like I've always got a place to go to, and I feel a million miles away from using. I know people say every day, it's, you know, take it every day. I feel a million miles away from using, but I still come here all the time to make sure I don't use again. So I'll leave it there. Thanks.